Very kindly been asked by Len Baron, first of all, to try to make a weekly radio program to share some of my thoughts about the arts, and most especially to share with you some of the recordings of poets, of music, some of the plays and dramas that I've collected over the years, things that are very, very special to me, and that I'd like to be able to give somehow to people at large. The opening piece of music, we don't even know who wrote that music. We know it is only as part of the great history of Heartland rock music. Well, I guess it's not correct to cast this music into the void of unknowability, because in some way we do know who wrote that music. It was, of course, none other than John Cougar Mellencamp. But it's not possible for anyone to say who made that music, because sadly, Mr. Cougar Mellencamp didn't have access to the 6,000-plus pianos he would have needed to record such a piece. And first of all, no one should blame Mr. Cougar Mellencamp, as I'd reckon there's not any human person who could manage to physically collect and arrange such a vast, vast quantity of pianos, not least in the same place at the same time. And then, when one tries to imagine how one would even go about then, being able to record them all together, simultaneously, live. But, as is often the case in life, one must make do. One must, as they say, make lemonade. So that rendition of Small Town that we heard at the beginning was a transmuted version of that song. It was an interpretation into thousands and thousands of pianos. What you heard is what I hear all the time. I only hear pianos. There are 88 keys on a piano. In theory, if one had enough pianos, say 6,000 pianos, for example, there would be enough piano keys that if the right notes were played in precisely enough a manner in rapid enough succession, it would be possible to transmute all sound into piano notes. What I'm trying to say here, every sound, no matter what it is, I only hear pianos. Voices, guitars, car horns, screams, growls, gunshots, creaking, thunder, rain, music, tires on gravel. Every sound, every cacophony that I hear in pianos, 6,000 pianos, probably even more, 18,000 pianos, 30,000 pianos, 620 million pianos, so many pianos you can't see anything else. Imagine 400 billion pianos. So many pianos that there is no space for people anymore. Imagine a world without people. No more plants. No more animals. Only pianos. Of course, you know, we got to be careful here to not digress too far down the rabbit hole. And while that's still in your ears and still in mind, I'd like to share with you a piece of music that was sent to me last week by a filmmaker whose works are often shown on the Monday evening series, Ryan Cullen. Ryan sent me a song from the Bruce Springsteen album, Born in the USA, and in many ways that was the impetus to put together this radio program, one that is dedicated to not so much the heartland as the pioneers and inventors of its sound. Musicians of the heartland rock genre are, in fact, responsible for fabricating an entire aesthetic history which never really existed. And today on this show, we are going to listen to some of the classics from this great fraud, and occasionally I will tune in to give a few words. Just to give a little background on the psychology and history and, well, I guess really the genesis of America's heartland. So, up now is a song from Born in the USA. It is a song about decline, something that all of us today should be quite familiar with. So, without further ado, Going Down. A few years ago, I went camping with a friend, Irina. Actually, she is going to have a little radio show on this station. I think, tomorrow at 6 p.m., probably about opera or some crap like that. Anyways, a few years back, we went camping in Vermont, together with a friend who is also a country musician himself, Tyler Barrier. And so we were driving on this very little dirt road through the mountains looking for a place to camp. And, well, we passed some people who were setting up their campsite. And they waved, and we waved. And you see, they had everything one would need for camping. In all honesty, we were very unprepared for the wilderness. So after that evening, after we had set up our little tent and everything, we walked over to their campsite, and whether it was to ask for water or wood or a lighter or beer, I don't know what it was precisely, but it was definitely an aid mission, so to speak. Well, us beggars from the city finally approached their campsite, and they were listening to country music real loud, you know, from big battery-powered speakers, and they were all drinking some type of very sweet, highly alcoholic iced tea or lemonade. Nonetheless, they only referred to it as beer, which we all found terribly interesting. Anyway, they offered us endless so-called beer, and we enjoyed ourselves with these strangers in the middle of the forest. We spoke about one of their minor league NASCAR careers and another's carpentry, but there was something peculiar which slowly revealed itself over the course of the evening. You know, they were native to Vermont, which is an American state which famously touches Canada. Well, these people, they all spoke with a southern accent. And over the course of the night, it became clear that not only had they rarely left Vermont, but nobody in their group had any connection with the southern United States. In other words, there was no reason for their speaking the way that they spoke. This might be the most obvious legacy of Heartland Rock, that regional accents became cultural accents, totally unbound from geography. A southern accent, a Texan accent, a Tennessee accent, an Ohio River Valley accent, all became flattened into a monolithic country accent. This accent could be used at will by anyone that needed to signal their accord with whatever this so-called country culture represented. Artificial cultural codes to be picked up and dropped, depending on the necessary posturing affiliations. Accent and affect became ideological, which I reckon is just another way to say that they became political. I also reckon that we all remember what the prophet Walter Benjamin said about introducing aesthetics into politics. The introduction of aesthetics into political life, of course being the imperative of fascism and its endlessly churning death machine. Heartland rock is defined less by a specific sound than by an ideological attitude. To make politics look like something. To make politics feel like something. To transform cultural variations into ideological allegiance. To transmute blue-collar culture into a sound. sound which could be appreciated just as much by the recently unemployed automobile factory workers of the 1980s as by their owners who moved the factory from Detroit to Southeast Asia. Heartland Rock was transformative insofar as it transformed the relations between the exploited and disposable working classes of the non-metropolitan regions of the United States and their keepers. Heartland Rock allowed factory owners the aesthetic sentiment of being exploited and disposable. It encouraged the factory owner and his wage slaves to sit around a radio together, drinking beers in the parking lot, fabricating an entirely immaterialist alliance where both owner and worker are equally exploited. By introducing politics into pop music, Heartland Rock abstracted class violence from a tangible historical reality into a cultural attitude. Heartland Rock allowed the factory owner an aesthetic solidarity with the workers he exploited, a solidarity which existed just up until the point when he fired them. A few songs back, we heard Fleetwood Mac's That's All Right. You can see this politics as style here, or anywhere in Heartland Rock, really. For example, Stevie Nicks's fixation on the spiritual revenge against a long-lost love is the same lost longing for a past when Bruce Springsteen was, and I quote, working on the highway. These are pasts which have never existed. Stevie Nicks has never seen a railway station. Bruce Springsteen has never touched a highway. In a manner of speaking, the heartland is a flexible instrument for weaponizing nostalgia. There's a time for nostalgia, of course, being about a past which never existed. Or, as Mike Kelly said, nostalgia is the repression of guilt. Think you're loving, baby, and all you do is crying. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Look at your game, girl. What a mad delusion, living in that confusion, frustration and doubt. Can you ever live without the game? The sad, sad game. Mad game. Just to say your love's not enough. If you can't be true, you can tell those lies, baby, but you're only fooling you. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Oh, look at your game, girl. If you can't feel and the feelings ain't real, then you better stop trying. Elements of the attitude are expressions of deeply seated aspects of American culture and history more broadly. Throughout the rest of this program, you will hear songs that explore tales of persecution that allow a glimpse inside the paranoid mind, the ultimate belligerence and inability for the humiliated subject to accept limitations. You will hear the unrealistic expectations this mythology has for autonomy and sovereignty, expectations which are incompatible with modern life, incongruous with any notion of society. You will hear repetitions of the same pathological obsession with what the humiliated subject deems liberty.
Turn.
For our heartland heroes, liberty constitutes the freedom to do whatever, whenever, to whomever, all the time. In other words, the freedom to behave like a child. And most concretely, you will hear the confused conflations between entitlement and exploitation, delusions of grandeur and persecution. In the universe of Heartland Rock, the exploited worker is also master of his destiny, captain of his soul. The worker who is one lost paycheck away from homelessness is somehow inexplicably in control of the situation. The idea of a lone factory worker who is alienated and exploited, yet at the same time empowered enough to tell his boss to fuck off. This is all to say that the very idea of the heartland is fantasy-based. It is fundamentally a fascistic enterprise dedicated to the perpetuation of a mythology. It is about ideology without history, and it is about giving that ideology not only an aesthetic, but an entire genre of music.
Did you know that there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard?
Outside the reactionary politics of much of the heartland genre of rock music, there is also a very tangible psychosexual angle, as we have just heard from Mellencamp and then the more contemporary Lana Del Rey. Here we see the humiliated subject finally getting what they want, which is to be hurt.
Six-inch valley through the middle of my skull. At night I wake up with the sheets soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of my head. Only you can cool my desire. Oh, I'm on fire. Oh, I'm on fire. Oh, I'm on fire.
What we can learn from Heartland Rock is what we can learn from yesteryear's subject. The subject who does not get what they want. This sadly seems to be a thing of the past. Increasingly, it appears that more and more people think that life is about getting what you want. This is not the case. Most, if not all, of the societal decay of the Western world can be traced to its population's instant fulfillment of their desires. Later this evening, you will hear a radio show from Mi Kai Elevandanabila. In it, in between Alessi Brothers, Bossa Nova, Mambo, and the like, he will discuss a proposition of the rehabilitation of the negative. This is what I speak of when I speak of not having desires fulfilled exactly as they are desired. Heartland Rock and its legacy of nostalgia is one possible line of flight from entropy. I know there are probably some listeners out there, if there are any listeners out there, who are asking what entropy is Stan talking about? And my answer to that question is the entropy of desire.
Ch-ch-ch.
Having every whim answered and every desire designed has created subjects which are more plant than human. If all we have left to desire is desire itself, this is a hell. Unless, of course, we can start to desire negativity, to desire disappointment, to desire unfulfillment, to learn to want in a new way, to learn to want to not get what we want. In this way that we should imagine Heartland Rock as an essentially sadomasochistic project not about individuals not getting what they want, but rather a project of bootlicking, a project of individuals getting what they desire, so long as what they desire is unrequited love. Catastrophe is all that the Heartland's horizon has to offer us if we cannot learn to do as pop musicians have over the decades, to cherish unfulfillment, to luxuriate in despair. There is one more song which I think wraps up this whole ridiculous knot I've tied around desiring to not desire. But before that, I want to summarize one noble truth, which I know to be true, and I assume you also have found to be true, and that is the truth that there is only one constant in life, and that constant is suffering.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, "Go to sleep, everything is all right." I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream.
If I try, I remember that you said.